supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Westchester authorities have called in federal investigators to assist in piecing together what caused a large nursing home complex to burn to the ground last night. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, more than 160 people, many elderly residents, were evacuated, and the fire is still not completely out, though there are no known fatalities.
It's a grim scene. The facility's remains are still smoldering. There are wheelchairs and loads of bed sheets littered around the gutted building. 27 were rushed to the hospital and 17 remain hospitalized. No word yet on fatalities. Westchester Mayor Jordan Norley says there are a handful of residents who remain missing, and there's a chance they just didn't make it out.
The scale and level of this fire is unprecedented in our community. We're yet to see really how this all flushes out and what the impact really is and the level of victims, frankly.
Don Robinson is a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
The fire is still burning in spots. We're still working the fire scene. We have not been able to enter the scene as of yet.
ATF isn't involved because foul play is suspected. Robinson says they're there to provide expert resources, like forensic specialists. He says determining the cause comes after figuring out who the missing are.
That's the number one priority, is making sure that we can account for everybody. And then the scene and how it happened will follow on.
Bill Barnes got a call around 11 p.m. Thursday about the fire. He dashed to the facility since his 82-year-old mother-in-law lived there. She got out safely.
It was scary. That's the best way to put it. You know, I haven't seen a fire around here that bad before. And basically, like I said, there's so many fire trucks and ambulances here, it's unbelievable.
Westchester resident Larry Kinglin awoke to sounds of windows smashing and flames whipping. He said he helped emergency responders push people out by wheelchair. Most were draped in sheets to stay warm. He says the fire was massive.
It was a sight that'll never leave my mind the rest of my life. It was just an amazing sight to see something that devastating.
Most of the elderly who were evacuated were transferred to another assisted living site in Kennett Square. Others were temporarily living out of cots in a gym at Westchester University. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
In Delaware, 76% of ex-offenders are rearrested within 3 years of their release. A simulation at Delaware State University gave political leaders and police officers a chance to see for themselves why that number is so high. WHYY Shirley Min also took part in the reentry exercise and offers this report.
You have 15 minutes. First week begins now.
During the hour-long reentry simulation in Dover, we assumed new identities with criminal histories and were required to do things like get photo IDs, check in with our probation officers, and search for a job. It sounds easy, but the process was entirely overwhelming and frustrating, especially when you don't have a car or any money because you can't get a job without an ID. I quit within the first 15 minutes. Delaware House Speaker Pete Schwarzkopf lasted longer, but was tossed back in jail before the hour was up.
It pushes you to do things that you shouldn't be doing, and which is what got him in jail in the first place.
By the end, two-thirds of us wound up back behind bars. Interestingly enough, the simulation numbers mirror real-life statistics in Delaware. Of the approximately 1,000 ex-offenders who are released each year from state prison, about 600 go back to jail.
When you're going to let somebody back out, you've got to give them the tools to help them to succeed. And we as a state can do that. We can, like I say, make sure they have the ID. That's the biggest thing coming out. Right off the bat, you're tripped right off the bat. So how do you compete in a 100-yard dash when you trip over the first obstacle?
Delaware public defender Sam Lukoff says the reentry system assumes ex-offenders have more support and resources than they actually have. She says it unintentionally sets them up to fail.
We get to know our clients pretty well and the communities that they come from. And these are communities with less resources than other communities and less jobs. The schools aren't great. There's often violence in these communities. So it absolutely sets it up to be very, very difficult for our clients to get back in.
After spending 13 years in prison for robbery, Brady Muhammad was lost when he got out, figuratively and literally.
For me, the amount of time that I spent in prison, a lot of things had changed in Wilmington. So I wasn't quite sure where this was at, where that's at, what bus to get on. So I really had to start over.
Project New Start helped Muhammad find his way. The intense 10-week job readiness program in Claymont helps people transition out of prison.
They taught me how to conduct myself in an interview, how to use a computer, which I had no computer skills. So that in itself was very helpful. When it was time for me to get my license, they helped with paying the monies that I need to get my license.
They're coming out with either no education, limited skills, no work history, a criminal record, lack of support, and lack of documents to help them go to work.
Project New Start Executive Director Priscilla Turgan believes reentry should begin back in the courtroom.
So as soon as an individual is sentenced, that time that they're spending in an institution should be time that they're being connected to skills, arrangements being made for housing, job training, job experiences, and these employment documents.
Turgan's success stories include Brady Muhammad and Sebastian Corbin. The 50-year-old was in and out of prison three times for assault and armed robbery. He was trapped on the recidivism merry-go-round.
Man, if you can't get employment, you can't be picked up, you tend to revert back to what it is that you know how to do to get money fast so you'll be able to survive.
But this time, it's different. Corbin, who now works for Owen Steele in Wilmington, says the program changed the way he thinks. Project New Start is the only reentry program in Delaware that makes the Alternatives to Violence program, or AVP, part of the curriculum. And Turgan says her students love it.
It's just different ways to handle problems, to handle trauma, to handle your anger, to handle conflict.
Research has shown AVP participants are less likely to get arrested again compared to those trying on their own. And to build on that,
so we start bringing our right thumb on our right nostril.
Turgan adds mindfulness and meditation training to drive it all home.
Take a deep breath through both, calmly relax your hands.
The nonprofit partners with various employers to help its students land jobs. In its 4 years, Project New Start has had 80 students. Of those, 52 graduated, 49 are working, and only 10 have gone back to jail.
Certainly this isn't a touchy-feely population to serve. And when we're out every day trying to get money to support our work, it's tough. We're not serving the victims, we're serving the perpetrators.
But public defender Sam Lukoff says it's in the public's best interest that reentry programs like Project New Start succeed.
I absolutely understand the issue of public safety and that we need communities to be safe and people to feel safe and to have our victims feel like they have been compensated in some way. But in reality, communities are safer when people who come back into the communities, these reentering citizens, when they have jobs, when they're able to be productive members, pay taxes, and they're not then going to want to or need to commit crime in order to sustain themselves or their families.
In Delaware, it costs $36,000 a year to keep someone in prison. Based on Project New Start's success, the program has saved the state about $1.5 million a year. From the Delaware desk, Shirley Min, WHYY News.
Now returned from his 12-day trip to Asia and the Philippines, President Donald Trump may focus more fully on domestic affairs. Let's look at the issues with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, how do Americans rank the most prominent problems?
Well, what's really key in our monthly update that we just finished is the low, low, low level of mention of economic problems. Only 15% of Americans mention any type of economic problem, and that would be jobs, the economy in general, inflation, anything along those lines. And that is the lowest we've seen technically going back to the dot-com boom in 1999, although we were within a point or two of it right before the recession back in 2007. What's replaced that? Government. Almost one out of four Americans spontaneously say something about the government, and that would include mentions of Trump. A lot of Democrats just say Trump's the biggest problem we face, but a lot of Republicans talk about inaction in Congress and so forth. And when we put all that together, that's the single largest problem that we have right now, followed by race relations, mentions of health care and immigration. And then at 5%, and this is important as well, 5% mention guns is our top problem.
Frank, I have to put Gallup on the defense. Apparently, President Trump feels that yours is among the services that purport fake news. He's pointing to a presidential poll that finds him with 46% approval.
That's right. Rasmussen has typically had approval ratings for the president much higher than other polls. And when that 46% number came out, President Trump obviously was watching television and seeing the much lower numbers being presented there. And he felt compelled, as it were, to tweet out that all these other polls are wrong. He said that, Dave. He said all these polls that are in the 30% range, quote, they are wrong. But I would say that if I look across all the polling that's done, reputable polling, polling that was very accurate when it estimated the national popular vote last November for a lot of these, all of these polls are in the range 35 to 40%. That would be Gallup's poll. Right now, Trump is at 37%. It'd be Quinnipiac, Marist, Politico, ABC, Washington Post, CBS, Pew, Ipsos, Reuters. The list goes on and on. All of these polls coalesce around an approval rating for Trump that is right in that 35 to 39% range. Rasmussen is an outlier. For one thing, they look only at likely voters, which tend to skew significantly more Republican than the national sample. And second, they use an interesting methodology that involves robocalling that tends to get just people with landlines who tend to be older, more likely to be Republican. They supplement that with some other kinds of online polling, but their methodology is certainly not in the mainstream for what other polls like Gallup do.
Problems with government, understandable. The Trump administration looking for their first major legislative win. Repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act has gone through several iterations, now focusing on taxes. Yet, there is an aspect of the Affordable Care Act that's now folded back in, that being eliminating the individual mandate. And so with that, what are attitudes around the Affordable Care Act?
We just updated it, and 50% of Americans right now say they approve of the Affordable Care Act, and 44% disapprove. And Dave, we follow up, and we say, if you approve, would you want further changes or keep it like it is? And then for the 44% who disapprove, we follow up and say, would you like to just have it changed some, or would you want it, quote, R&R, repealed and replaced? And when you do that, you come down to only 29% of Americans who say they want the Affordable Care Act repealed and replaced. So there is not, and I'll repeat, there is not an overwhelming mandate from the people taken as a whole to replace the Affordable Care Act, although a lot of Americans would clearly like the idea of seeing it tweaked in some ways.
To what extent is there an impetus to go in the other direction, that being a single-payer system?
We tested that, and that's kind of interesting. You know, we have a question we've asked over time that we just updated, which is a little more generic. That is, do you prefer a government-run system, or do you prefer one run by private insurance? And in the old days, you know, past days, we've had as low as just a third of Americans who support a government-run system, and now that's up to 47%. We did follow up and ask a very specific question. We took Senator Sanders' proposal, and put these phrases in it: Medicare for all, single-payer, administered by the government, financed by taxes. And what we got back was 61% said, I don't know. We gave them that option, and they said, I simply don't know enough about a single-payer system to have an opinion on it. And those who did have an opinion split about equal. So Sanders' push for this single-payer system has a long way to go before Americans understand it, A, and B, approve of it.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. This weekend, Princeton University will host a symposium that will air its own involvement in the institution of slavery. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the Princeton and Slavery Project has been a deep dive into the university's past, 5 years in the making.
If an historian would take a hard look at almost any American institution going back 200 years or so, it's likely slavery will pop up somehow. It's one of the unfortunate natures of American history. But Princeton was unique among the nation's early universities because it was a northern school that attracted a lot of students from the South. Historian Martha Sandwy said before the Civil War, about 40% of the student body came from southern states, and the university administration at the time did not want to stir tension by talking about slavery.
A battle in the Revolutionary War was fought on our campus and won by the Patriots. The Continental Congress met in Nassau Hall, right on our campus. So in many ways, we are a face of liberty, but we were also a campus where enslaved people were sold in 1766. So our campus really embodies that paradoxical intertwining of liberty and slavery that lies at the core of so much of American history.
Sandweiss spearheaded the Princeton and Slavery Project, in which students poured through university archives asking two basic questions. Who owned slaves? And whose money came from the Institute of Slavery? Their results are now published on a website featuring 90 stories, 370 primary sources, and interactive maps, graphics, and videos. Since it launched last week, more than 10,000 people from 95 countries have visited the site. What Sandweiss's team found was that slaves were indeed sold right there on campus. After one of its early presidents, Samuel Finley, died in 1766, his possessions were auctioned off in front of the president's house on Nassau Street. That included the sale of five slaves. The project also dove into one of the university's early donors, Moses Taylor Pine, whose enormous financial support of Princeton transformed the campus at the turn of the century.
He was absolutely our most generous benefactor in the late 19th and early 20th century. His money helped pay for some very important buildings on our campus. But his fortune came directly from his grandfather, and his grandfather was a New York merchant who made his money trading with sugar plantations in Cuba, places that thrived on the back of enslaved labor.
The Princeton and Slavery Project has nothing to do with the recent student protests to eradicate the name of Woodrow Wilson from campus buildings because the former president of the university and former president of the United States was a staunch segregationist. The History Project predates that demonstration by a few years, and it is not intended to be a form of protest. Sandweiss says her work is rooted in academics, designed to inform the public as fully as possible about a mostly unknown past.
Moving forward, whatever conversations ensue on our campus about monuments or naming or race will be very well-informed conversations, because I really feel like we've given people a lot of data.
The weekend symposium will also feature new artwork, a documentary film, and a series of commissioned theatrical plays. Sandweiss says artists can talk about history in ways that historians cannot. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
There's a call out for Nerdtinos to gather tomorrow in Philadelphia, which will host what's described as the first Latinx comic book convention on the East Coast. Joining me with a preview is Sabrina Vorvulius, science fiction and fantasy author, and Nerdtino Expo 2017 panelist. Sabrina, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get some definitions here. Latinx.
It is the non-gendered form of saying Latino, Latina. It's more encompassing, not as binary.
Now, this is in at least part a comic book convention, yet you are an author in both novel and short story format. Have you dabbled in comics as well?
I have not, although I do have a short story that I think is absolutely ripe to be a graphic novel. But I do think, you know, there's a lot of overlap. I go to a convention in Boston called Aresia. They have a whole stream of sci-fi, fantasy writing-oriented stuff, and lots of cosplaying, and lots of comic book, and lots of gaming. So there's a lot of overlap.
What's a Nerdtino?
It's a Latino or Latinx nerd.
Do you count yourself in that cohort?
Oh, do I ever. At one point in our lives, my brothers, who are also both Latino nerds, I was going on and on about how many times I had read The Lord of the Rings, and did that make me a nerd? And I think my younger brother said, that defines the nerd.
So you wear that badge with pride.
Absolutely.
So you're going to be presenting on a couple of the panels. First off, the state of Latinx speculative fiction. What is that genre?
Speculative includes science fiction, fantasy, magical realism, horror, what is known as slipstream. So, for example, Carmen Maria Machado, who's a Philadelphia writer who has seen her work in The New Yorker and Granta, writes speculative fiction with an element of surrealism or the unexplained in it. She's a finalist for the National Book Award.
You're a Philadelphia writer as well, with roots in Guatemala, and your first novel was based on experiences in that country.
It was, but it was also very much about being a Latina in the United States and growing up as a Latina in the United States. I came here when I was 15, so, you know, I have sort of two lifetimes, the one spent in Guatemala and the one here.
And in that interim, diversity and representation in geek media has evolved. That's your second topic. What are the parameters of that aspect as well?
Well, we know that representation is a tremendous issue for Latinos and people of color across the board, politically, in movies, and definitely in speculative fiction and the comic book world. It's all becoming a far richer world as we see better representation.
Obviously, the legacy of South American and Spanish writers is vast and goes back centuries. Who are the current practitioners of this type of genre, though, whether it's comic book or science fiction?
Well, as I mentioned, Carmen Maria Machado is local. Daniel Jose Older and his sister Malca Older. Daniel's work, he just has released a second young adult book. His first, Shadow Shaper, got a lot of attention. Carlos Hernandez, who's a Cuban writer, who wrote The Assimilated Cuban's Guide to Quantum Santeria, is another big name.
History is, break it down, his story. And I know it's important through your page that you have an opportunity to create and take control of your own story. And I don't mean to really mean you personally.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think, you know, the Latino voices in the United States are really important and are very varied and diverse experiences in the United States are, you know, underrepresented and are significant.
Again, tomorrow in Philadelphia, hosting an expo noted as the first Latinx-focused comic book convention on the East Coast, Nerdtino Expo 2017. Sabrina, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Sabrina Vorvulius, author and panelist on tomorrow's convention. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader, with help this week from Edward Saakashvili. Our news director is Eugene Son, assistant news director Katie Culinary. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. At the helm this week, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.